I'm Nicolas Véran. I'm a senior fellow at Bruegel and also a visiting fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Bruegel and the Peterson Institute are two non-academic economic policy research organizations. Bruegel is in Brussels, the Peterson Institute is in Washington. They do more or less the same thing in their respective European and American environment, which is to produce research, analysis, and organize debates to contribute to better economic policymaking, so to create an interface also between academic research, civil society, including the business community, and policymaking circles. My research focuses on financial regulation and financial systems, and I'm going to speak here about global financial reform and how it has developed since the start of the global financial crisis. I should say, actually, the North Atlantic financial crisis, because if you look at it from a really global point of view and you look at how things have been seen from China or Australia or other parts of Asia or the emerging world, it really hasn't been a financial crisis for them. They have had other problems. But let's call it the global financial crisis from a sort of Western-centric perspective. The sequence of the crisis is well known. What has really been important in the development of global financial reform has been the elevation of the G20 from a relatively obscure group of finance ministers and central bank governors to a meeting of heads of state and government in October-November 2008, so with the first G20 summit of heads of state and government in Washington, D.C. in mid-November 2008. This was a direct consequence of the fall of Lehman Brothers and the unprecedented financial turmoil that happened in late September and early October 2008. And this prompted the realization that really the way things were being done piecemeal and in a sort of fragmented manner, not joined up between different jurisdictions, was completely behind the curve compared with the global financially integrated nature of the financial system and the sort of interconnections and links and also contagion channels that meant that 2 weeks after Lehman defaulted, Europe was plunged into a major financial crisis from which it unfortunately hasn't emerged yet. And therefore, leaders of Europe suggested that there should be a meeting of heads of state and government. George Bush at this time, president of the US, accepted, but on the conditions that this would be on a format that would include the major emerging economies and not just the usual G7 countries or Western countries. And this is how the G20 summits were born. They have been really important as a way to coordinate initiatives at the global level and also to empower a number of processes which are of a more technical nature, but which would not have moved forward the way they did in the subsequent years if there hadn't been for this major political push in the G20 summit of Washington in November 2008, in the following summits, especially in London in April 2009, in Pittsburgh in September 2009, and to a certain extent, perhaps a lesser extent, the other G20 summits that have followed in Toronto, Seoul, Cannes, and now Los Cabos, so respectively in Canada, South Korea, France, and Mexico. If you look at what has been done since 2007-2008 in terms of global financial reform, well, you know, it's a long catalogue of initiatives, and many of them are of a highly specialized nature. I'm not going to go into all of them here, but I'll mention a few things. One is the initiative to dramatically strengthen the requirements on banks' capital and also liquidity, leverage, and risk management, which is known as the Basel III Capital Accord, which was negotiated within a pre-existing structure, the Basel Committee on Banking Regulation, on Banking Supervision, sorry, which was established in the 1970s and has been producing such capital accords, which are non-binding indicative standards on how individual nations or jurisdictions should regulate bank capital. But the pre-existing framework, which was known as Basel II, has been proven by the crisis to be very insufficient. And therefore, the Basel Committee negotiated a very comprehensive, very far-reaching, and to a large extent innovative approach to dramatically tighten, some would say not enough, but fairly dramatically tighten the requirements on basically the bank's ability to resist to financial shocks, both in terms of liquidity and in terms of capital, so buffers that enable banks to absorb financial shocks, to absorb losses. Here too, I'm not going into the details, but let me just say that this accord, which was negotiated in 2009 and 2010 and was published in its initial form in late 2010, goes quite far in terms of tightening the screws, and certainly farther than many observers, including, I must admit, myself, would have thought possible at the beginning of the process. So I think it does illustrate the fact that there has been a reform dynamic at the global level, catalyzed by the Basel Committee in this case, that hasn't been insubstantial. There have been other initiatives, of course. One is a major effort to organize in a more transparent way the markets for financial derivatives, and particularly clear the negotiation of clear derivatives contracts, derivatives transactions on organized clearing platforms, even when those derivatives contracts are negotiated bilaterally or, as the jargon has it, over the counter, but clear them centrally so that supervisors can get a better sense of what's happening in that space, and more importantly, so that so-called counterparty risk, so the risk that your counterparty would default in a transaction, would be appropriately mitigated. We have a decision of the Pittsburgh Summit of the G20, so September 2009, that all standardized, so-called standardized over-the-counter derivatives should be cleared centrally in so-called central counterparties by the end of this year, 2012, or 1st of January 2013. Whether this deadline will be met remains very much in question. Whether it will be done in a way that proves sustainable is even more in question. So this is very much work in progress. And then there have been plenty of other initiatives to accelerate the convergence of accounting standards globally, to look at remuneration schemes. This is a very politically charged topic in financial institutions so that they don't incentivize traders and other executives to go for excessive risk-taking. To supervise credit rating agencies so that the shortcomings of their supervision of credit risks that have been very apparent, particularly in the U.S. Residential mortgage-backed securitization market, would not happen again. And a whole host of other issues that I'm not going to mention exhaustively. So, as I mentioned, there are a couple of successes, Basel III being perhaps the more unambiguous one from my perspective. But we also have to keep in mind that this is still very much a work in progress, and it's too early to really judge the ultimate success of the most prominent planks of this global financial reform agenda and of financial reforms that have happened at the level of individual countries or jurisdictions, such as the Dodd-Frank Act in the US. And there is a lot of resistance. Resistance comes from different sides. One is national resistance based on sovereignty. countries don't like to be told what to do by anything that exists at the global level, be it a committee, a standard setter, a treaty-based organization, or whatever other form of organizations that exists at the global level. Other resistances, of course, are of a different political nature, but not necessarily less potent. Financial firms, private sector, market participants resist regulatory initiatives that would basically have a negative impact on their ability to make money, or bureaucracies resist initiatives that would limit their power. So there are all sorts of different or public authorities that have made major misjudgments in the past, resist initiatives that would make those failures, such as, for example, supervisory failures in many jurisdictions, that were initiatives that would make these failures visible. So I think, of course, one type of resistance which I have mentioned, which is a resistance by the financial industry against measures that would constrain their profits, is well publicized, but it's not the only form of resistance that reform initiatives have encountered. There are many other aspects that make this dynamic of global financial reform very difficult. If you look at the two main, probably most advanced, I mean, in my view, most advanced sets of financial standards that exist, one is what I mentioned, capital standards and other bank regulatory standards published by the Basel Committee, so Basel III and the previous accords, Basel II, Basel 2.5, if you want to talk the Basel jargon, on the one hand. On the other hand, international accounting standards, known as International Financial Reporting Standards, or IFRS, which are set by a global standard-setting committee based in London. Those two very important sets of financial standards have been arguably bolstered by the global financial crisis in terms of stakeholders all around the world understanding or realizing that the need for globally consistent standards was there, but also they have run into a number of difficulties. These difficulties are about adoption. Some countries or jurisdictions have not adopted these standards, the best example being the fact that the U.S., apart from foreign issuers listed in the U.S., has not yet adopted or incorporated IFRS into its own legal and regulatory framework. Similarly, the U.S. has not adopted some earlier sets of standards from the Basel Committee, including the so-called Basel II Accord. But it's not only the question of whether jurisdictions adopt a standard or don't, it's also how they adopt it. Do they really comply with the entirety of the global rule or not? If you take the example of accounting standards, or IFRS, the European Union has adopted them almost in full, but not entirely in full. There are minor variations, one main minor variation between what the European Union has incorporated into its own legal framework and IFRS as published by the International Accounting Standards Board. If you look at other jurisdictions such as China, India, Singapore, and others, there are many more variations between what they have adopted, even when it has been largely based on IFRS, and the exact letter of IFRS, not even mentioning translation issues. As for the Basel Accords, it's too early to say how the implementation of Basel III will go in the U.S. The U.S. Specialized agencies, the Federal Reserve, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation and the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency have very recently published a first proposal on how Basel III would be incorporated in the U.S., but There will be a lot of discussion, and it's too early to tell whether this implementation will be complete and compliant with Basel III. In the case of the European Union, there is a legislative discussion which is also ongoing, and it is already very likely that some aspects, at least, of the implementation of this capital and liquidity and leverage standards will not be the same in the EU legislation, in the European Union legislation, as they are in the standard issued by the Basel Committee. So, and even more important, the way they will be implemented, including assuming there is full adoption, the way they will be implemented will vary a lot, or is likely to vary a lot from one jurisdiction to another. So, there's a sort of cat-and-mouse game here. The global standard setters, to a certain extent, backed by the leaders of the G20 and also buttressed by some other mechanisms, such as a number of processes that are managed by the International Monetary Fund and the Financial Stability Board, which is a coordination structure with a permanent staff based in Basel, in the same building as the Basel Committee, actually. There are a number of mechanisms that empower the standard setters to do more to make sure that their standards are, or to, not to make sure, but to facilitate and incentivize the adoption, full adoption, and consistent implementation of their standards in jurisdictions across the world. And actually, there has been a lot of progress being made in that particular area of so-called implementation monitoring, in the past few years, even in the past 12 months, both by the Basel Committee and by the International Accounting Standards Board and by other global standard setters, which I've not mentioned, such as the International Organization of Securities Commissions, the International Association of Insurance Supervisors, and a number of others. So I think you see this cat and mouse game, this back and forth between resistances by individual jurisdictions or by financial sector market participants against these global financial reform initiatives and the standard, global standard setters or global authorities responding to these resistances and adopting new initiatives to make sure that they can be overcome. So it's a work in progress. I think the initiatives taken since 2007, 2008 have arguably contributed to making the financial system more resilient. But I would also say that there are a lot of question marks about how this will develop in the future, how the current job is going to be finished, and what will be the future dynamics of this constantly changing question of global financial reform. Some people think, you know, it's easy, you have to reform the financial system, and when it's done, it's done. But this is completely misleading because the financial system is constantly evolving. So reforming the financial system is more like, you know, curing a disease or healing a patient. You might heal the patient at some point, but that doesn't mean that his or her health will remain excellent for the rest of his or her life. So you have to monitor and to adapt to treatment and to adapt the sort of things you're looking at, because it's a constantly evolving system. So what will be the next steps? I think the steps already taken, I've mentioned this already at length, have to be consolidated and strengthened. Some lines of work have to be finished. In other lines of work, the systems that have been put in place and the structures that have been put in place must now be operated and maintained so that they don't lose in terms of strength and authority. There are things that frankly need to be done and haven't been done yet. We don't have the right structures and processes and institutions on a number of aspects of this global financial reform agenda. Let me just mention one which is actually very central. There are a number of globally integrated firms which are subjected to fragmented supervision on a jurisdiction by jurisdiction or country by country basis, and this is fundamentally a recipe for regulatory arbitrage and future problems. And this applies to globally integrated banks, especially investment banks, globally integrated audit networks, globally integrated rating agencies, globally integrated financial market infrastructure. I've mentioned clearing houses or trading platforms or data repositories or settlement systems, not entering into too many details, but a number of global financial players which are very integrated on a global basis, including on their day-to-day operations, and still remain supervised by, you know, the US authorities, the Chinese authorities, the European authorities, or even in some cases the national authorities of each member state in the European Union. This creates difficulties, and I think there is a question mark now that there is a push towards more assertive, rightly so, with the lessons of the crisis, towards more assertive and intrusive regulation and supervision. Can we continue to have this regime of fragmented supervision of globally integrated firms? And this is a huge question mark, not only for the next few years, but I think for the next few decades. It has a very clear implication in terms of the continuation of global financial integration. Global financial system has tended to integrate globally in the past 2-3 decades, and my view, which is not necessarily shared by all analysts, is that this has been hugely beneficial for the world economy on the whole, but it has also created a number of risks which haven't been properly addressed or mitigated so far, and with some of which have been illustrated by the global financial crisis, some of which haven't materialized yet, but could well materialize in the years or decades to come. So how do we adjust the global financial supervisory system and regulatory system to the increasingly globally integrated nature of the global financial system, I think remains a completely open question, which is not going to be answered in a definitive way anytime soon. In a way, the European Union is a cautionary tale, because the European Union is an example, especially inside the Eurozone, of very advanced market integration, banking, and capital markets integration, but with, until now, only a limited extent of integration of regulatory, let alone supervisory structures. And actually, one way to read the Eurozone crisis is that there has been a mismatch between the level of integration of the financial system and the level of integration of the policy infrastructure, including banking supervision in particular. This is a very central factor in the Euro crisis. This is the reason why so many European leaders are talking about the banking unions these days, because they finally came to the realization that this was not just a fiscal crisis or a sovereign debt crisis, but also very much a crisis of the financial system itself and of its inadequate supervisory structure. So this is a cautionary tale. It shows that when you integrate markets, you also have to integrate the policy framework to a very significant degree if you want financial stability. The world doesn't have that so far, and I think we'll continue to discuss these issues at a technical level, but also at a political level, for many years to come. Thank you very much.